Blog Talk Radio.
Good to be with you.
Thank you. I'm really glad you're here.
I know we had a little bit of a mix-up, but everything's cool now.
Yes, exactly. Anyway, so you did like a book on a collection of short stories, like Haley's Gift, Eight Other Extraordinary Tales, and things like that. What started you writing? Did you start young or did you start recently? When did you begin?
Well, that's a good question. Well, I've been writing, for my professional life, but most of that's been technical in nature, including a book on questionnaire design for business research. And as I was, two things kind of simultaneously happened. I was, preparing for my retirement, and at the same time, I was downsizing some of the cars I owned. I tended to play around with some of the British Roadsters and so forth. And so I was selling them and a car for my mom and dad. And so I was told that if you write a story about the object you're trying to sell on eBay, that you get more eyeballs. So I thought, well, what the heck? So I wrote stories for every one of the cars that I was selling, and lo and behold, I did get more eyeballs. And the stories, I guess, resonated. Then I decided, well, this is fun. I'll write some stories about my dogs and my cars. And eventually I ended up with a collection. And my daughter said to me, Dad, you should put those into a book. Do a collection of short stories. And, of course, I dismissed it a little bit at the beginning. But being the good daughter she is, she nagged me. But in a loving way. And that's what launched me. That's what launched the fiction writing career.
That's interesting. That's different, too.
Yeah, a little out of the ordinary.
Do you read a lot? All right, what kind of books do you enjoy?
Yes, I read quite a bit. I like the classics. I'm a big fan of Kurt Vonnegut. I like Twain. I'm eclectic. Right now I'm reading something that's kind of out of my comfort zone, but I was in the bookstore and just caught my eye. And it was a book by Colin Cotterhill, there's no H in it, Cotterhill. And the name of the book is The Merry Misogynist. You got to admit that's the title. So,
appropriate today.
Yes, exactly. I think maybe that's what triggered it for me.
Is it good?
It is. I'm really enjoying it. Yes. He's a very talented writer.
Interesting. I have this weird eclectic mind myself. I jump from genre to genre a lot. I mean, I read mysteries, then I read science fiction, then I read a good biography, then I read an archaeological.
Right.
Do you tend to jump or do you stick to the same genre for a while? Or how
I'm very much like you. I tend to jump. A good biography. I read. I think the author's name is McCullough. I think his name is. He wrote a biography about the Kitty Hawk, and the Wright brothers, and stunningly done. I mean, well written, but also extraordinarily well researched, and gave me a new perspective on that whole era, not just, what they were doing, but what was going on around them at the time. And I never realized how much time they spent over in Europe, in France in particular.
There was a mutual interest, all flyers were really together, and there was a mutual interest that they would write letters and to visit each other by ship.
Right, right. It wasn't a short. It was a real commitment to making those visits.
Yes, exactly. But it's really interesting. Yeah, flight and space are things that I'm fascinated. And that's another section of books I read a lot: astronomy and exploration. One of my heroes growing up when I was a kid was Neil Armstrong, so I was already into it.
Have you ever read the book, the title is, I think it's Astrophysics for Somebody in a Hurry or People in a Hurry, something of that nature. I'm not sure if that's the exact title, but The Grassy Road. It's a short book, but it's actually got quite a punch. So anybody who's interested in astrophysics, might want to pick that up.
No, I never read that, but I'm a huge space nut. I mean, and the things, the strides they're doing in astronomy and space exploration through the Kepler thing, it's just phenomenal. I watch a show called The Planets, and they have a thing called the UNNOVA, which I've never heard of before. Have you?
No, I haven't.
The UNNOVA is, instead of a dying star exploding in a supernova, it explodes on itself and becomes a black hole. But they said one day it'll be a bright sun and the next day it will just blink out. You would not have a sun anymore.
Yeah. Well, I was looking
like,
at.
Rock
yeah, go ahead,
me.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
No. Yeah. Well, black holes are scary. There's, just thinking about them for me at least. It's sort of a scary phenomenon out there. And I was also reading about how the planets and revolve around the sun and how the sun is moving through the galaxy and how the galaxy is spinning, and it's all described as a vortex, and it's mind-boggling, for the simple-minded who think that, the planets are just running around the sun and the sun's going to just sitting there. Not so.
Yeah, they actually said that the idea that our galaxy just quietly sits there and does its job and runs around, that's all, our perception. It's not real.
Exactly.
The planets, including our planet, move its trajectory around the sun. Planets have moved into different orbits and moved back and then moved over, and some of them have been kicked out. There were other planets in our thing, and they call Jupiter the big bully because Jupiter keeps throwing planets out and moving their orbit. But it's also our big brother and protects us, because if it wasn't there, a lot of bad stuff could have happened to us. And that's why we have our little quiet, nice, safe existence, because of the big bully Jupiter.
No, really? That I didn't know. Well, this is a very educational call for me.
I love learning new things. I love to talk about what people read and what they like, not just about, we'll talk about your writing, don't worry, but I also like to talk about all kinds of stuff. Do you have a type of hobby? Do you have a thing that you do outside of your writing that it doesn't, light the passion for your writing? Do you have anything like that?
I think the closest thing, other than my family, that I could describe in that way would be my my dog. And this is our this is the fourth dog that I've rescued from a shelter, and each one of them has had been a in their own way unique and wonderful gift to have the relationship with each one of them. And this dog, his name is Motto, M-A-T-O. I gotta tell you, he's probably the best of the bunch. He's such a good, such a good boy. I know every pet owner says that, but this dog is really something special.
Aww, how sweet is that? And what kind of a dog is it? What's the mix?
Well, that's a very good question, and I don't have a good answer. We call him the Wonder Dog because we wonder what he is all the time. And people come up and ask the same question, and I basically say, well, what do you think he looks like? And then they tell me, and I say, yeah, that's what he is.
Yeah. I really prefer mutts to purebreds. I love all animals. I love all dogs and all, like, cats and all animals. I like mixed breeds. They're just so sweet. They have the best dispositions.
Well, my daughter actually saved this dog, you know, from the euthanasian that he was scheduled for. He was very sick. He came in as a puppy to the shelter, and she was getting her PhD in Texas at the time, and she was you know, taking care of some dogs at home. You know, they have a program where I guess I forget what they call that, but it in any event. They were saying, this dog is too sick. She, you know, we're not going to be, we have to, you know, put him down. And she said, no, let me take him home. I'll foster him for, you know, a couple of days, see what happens. Make a long story short, a couple of weeks later, and apparently a lot of peanut butter was involved, she got him healthy. And we had just lost the dog we had. And she called me and said, Dad, I know you're still, you know, missing Franklin, which was the other dog's name, and it may be too early, but this is a great dog, and I really wish you would think about it. And at first, I said, well, we'll see, you know. She convinced me, and my son was visiting her at school, and he met the dog. And he's not emotional or anything. He's a very, you know, solid guy. And he said to me, Dad, you got to take this dog. This is the most unassuming dog you'll ever meet. I said, okay, Adam. we had him brought up to Massachusetts, and we've been happy ever since.
Oh, unassuming. I like that as a description for a dog.
Isn't that something? Yeah, he said he just looks like he's just happy to be alive, and I guess, you know, in a way that made a lot of sense given the situation. So he's, you know, very trainable. Can walk without a lead if need be. Loves kids. You know, loves to meet people. Always attracts attention no matter where we go. You know, we were at a festival up in, Newburyport. And, we couldn't walk three steps before another person was coming up and asking, can I pet your dog? You know, so. I told my wife we're going to rent him out to the high school boys here, you know, as a magnet for girls.
I called them the dogs that would help the burglar with the flashlight dog. They're not really watchdogs. They're more friendly.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like he's like, oh, you want to come? Okay, come on in and pet me. It's okay.
Yeah. No matter who comes to visit, it's, you know, I think he assumes they came really basically to see him.
I love that kind. I love dogs, but I love that. That kind of a dog is so sweet.
Yeah. And he's a good guy.
Is it a boy or girl?
It's a male dog. He's about, let's see. I think the last time we weighed him, he was 65 pounds. So he's not small, but, you know, he's not enormous either. The last dog we had before that was American Bulldog, at least in part. I'm not sure what else. He was closer to 90 pounds, and he had a very interesting habit. He thought he was a lap dog.
Oh, that's funny. A roommate of mine had a Doberman Pinscher who was the sweetest dog. She never got the ears fixed, and I think that really is one of the reasons, because he was just the sweetest dog. But he forgot he was a Doberman Pinscher, and he kept trying to sit on everybody's lap.
Yeah.
Oh, no, 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 no. No brownie move.
Well, I tell you, in the wintertime, you know, here in Massachusetts, when Franklin would sit on my lap, it was welcome. You know, he would keep you really warm.
But now in the summer?
Well, summer was a little, you know, but he didn't like, he didn't like sitting in your lap in the summer as much either because, you know, he would always, you know, lie on the kitchen tile floor to stay cool, you know, so, yeah. But in the wintertime, he liked to cuddle.
What's your new dog's name?
My dog's name is Mato, M-A-T-O, which in a Native American language of, I think in the South Dakota, one of the South Dakota nations, that word means bear. And the reason that my daughter picked that name for him is because he looked like a little bear cub when he was a puppy. He really did.
Adorable. Oh, I know. I watch a lot of nature shows too, and you know what dogs I really have fallen in love with are the prairie dogs. They are the sweetest little things in the whole wide world.
Oh, is that right? Prairie dogs, huh?
Yeah, because and they're like their families, and they warn each other of predators, and they're so protective of each other. They had this part where a snake was attacking the family, and the prairie dog, he went over and he's like hitting the snake from behind. It could have killed him, and the announcer says the prairie dog was well aware that this was dangerous, but he was protecting his snake, and he was jumping behind it and hitting it until the snake went away, which it did. But it was like, I just like, wow, isn't that, it's just overwhelming what the instinct of that dog was, and I fell in love with them, and they're so cute. They have the cutest faces.
Yeah, we underestimate the selfishness or selflessness, sorry, of animals, and you know, and the care that animals in the wild give one another. It's underreported. It's underappreciated, I think.
I don't remember what show. Oh yeah, it was Blue Planet. A jellyfish was being stalked by a shark, and he covered himself in shells, so like armor. So the shark knew he was there, but he couldn't find him because the shells just totally threw him off. And as soon as it went away, he went.
Smart. That's smart. You know, they have an enormous amount of neurons, and the neurons go throughout their whole body. They're very highly intelligent.
Yep. And another one was an octopus a shark was attacking, and it actually knew how to fight the shark. It put its claws or fins or whatever you call those little arms into the shark's gills, so it couldn't breathe. And as soon as the shark gave up, it ran. But it's like the animal kingdom is so people. That's why we have to protect it, because the animal kingdom is so beautiful, and they're so smart.
Yes, no, I agree totally. You know, these ecosystems. We're dependent on them, and more than I think we truly realize. And given the way what's happening with the planet and climate change, if you subscribe to it, which I certainly do, you just want to go and do whatever you can to lower your own carbon footprint, and then get others to do the same.
You're absolutely right.
We're very proud because our electric bill, we get this thing from the electric company. It shows, you know, how many kilowatts you've used and compared to your neighbors. And there's three categories: everybody, those people who are energy efficient, and then you. And we're always lower than the energy efficient people. So I'm like, yes.
That's really good. It's very important, and people don't realize we are able to breathe because of two things, the jungle, the Amazon jungle, and any of the tropical rainforests. And the coral reefs where the plankton come, those are the two things that make oxygen in our air. And if we destroy either the coral reef or the Amazon forest, which we're working really hard to do, we won't have any oxygen.
Yeah, well, there's actually a third source, which is this enormous ring of trees around the northern rim of the planet. And you can trace it all the way, you know, across Canada and across large swaths of Russia, and that it's mostly evergreen. That contributes enormous amount of oxygen to the planet.
It's just so important that each and everything, the plankton, the Amazon birds, the trees you're talking about, they're vital, not just to their little the small environment, but the entire environment.
Yeah. Right. It's not just their immediate ecosystem, but the entire planet. You know, it's one big breathing entity, one full size tree, like a maple tree, provides enough oxygen for two people.
I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you just have one big tree in your backyard, that's not going to really help you, right? Because the oxygen doesn't stay planted where the tree is. You know, there's such a thing as wind, right? So but the idea is that if we have enough trees, we actually we'll be okay when it comes to at least a supply of oxygen. But if, as you say, we keep destroying those ecosystems, we're going to be in serious trouble.
Exactly. We're part of the planet. We're not a separate entity.
Yeah. One of the things I love about where I live, in the city of Newton, which is 10 miles directly west of Boston, it's called the Garden City, and there's a good reason for it. I mean, you cannot throw a pebble and not hit a tree. I mean, there are trees everywhere. it's really, except when we have storms, which can be a little tricky. It's really quite delightful.
We're at the point where I want you to have plenty of time to talk about your book. Can you please tell a little bit about your book, who you think your customers would be most interested in, and how they can get it?
Okay, well, the novel I've just released this summer is titled Caitlin's Mooring, and you might have guessed from the title that the lead character is a woman named Caitlin, in this case a 20-year-old young woman, 20 years of age. And the book starts out with you sort of being introduced to her through the dilemma that she is facing right from the get-go. She is currently at Boston University, which is right down the street from me, a little further than down the street, but anyway, in the neighborhood. And there's just sort of a double whammy, if you will, something that's happening with her personally and then something that's happening in her home, which is in Owl's Head, Maine, which is quite far up on the coast near Rockland, if anybody knows where that is. I'm not sure how much to give away about what's happening, because I don't want to ruin it for anyone. But this is a story that spans five generations of the DuVaux family, it involves the kernel for the story came actually from a conversation I was having with someone in Maine during a conference a few years back. It was a conference of authors and so forth. And over lunch, this young woman was telling me how, she didn't tell me exactly why this had occurred, but somehow in her family, her son had no father and no grandfather, but he did have a great-grandfather. And I was very intrigued, as she told me, how they bonded and the importance of this relationship. Very intrigued about that this young man, or young boy, really, and this his great-grandfather had bound it and found, he found it sort of, helped each other through what I'm sure had, there was some tragedy involved for there to be a gap. Now, I didn't pry and she wasn't, you know, telling, but that's okay. I just, you know, came away with that thought and decided that it was a very interesting sort of, you know, relationship event that, you know, wasn't all that common. So I decided to write the story around that. And that's how the book started to evolve.
Fascinating. And who do you think would enjoy it? Is it for everybody? Is it for a certain kind of genre fan?
I'd love to say it's for everybody, but, you know, you and I both know that that's not true. You know, it's a family fiction book. I suspect, and from the early returns of, you know, people's comments and so forth, I think that it's probably going to be more of interest to women than men. But I don't know that, you know, there are no men who would like it. And there are, you know, there are three chapters that are action-packed. They take, you know, there are scenes that take place out at sea. Two in the Atlantic and one in the Mediterranean. And so, you know, there's something a little, you know, it's not just, you know, for want of a better term, and sorry to be, to use this, but it's not chick flick, you know, or chick, you know, a chick book in that sense. And it's not, but it is very emotional. You go through a lot of emotions, I feel you do, as this family is, you know, trying to find ways to meet the challenges that it's faced.
You know, you picked up one of my least favorite descriptive words for a book or a movie,
yeah,
or a TV show.
Right. Well, that's what I'm saying. I hesitate to use it, but you know, it's not that. That's what I'm trying to say. It's not whatever people think of that, you know, in that phrase. It really is a book for someone who enjoys learning about other people and how they meet challenges and you know, how a family's resilience, if you will, can you know, make the difference. It's a fast read. It's not, it doesn't take, you know, too long to get through it. But it's a, you know, it's a full length novel, and people have said to me, you know, that they don't want to put it down, that, you know, they like turning the pages, as it were, so they get through it quickly.
And where can they get it? Is there on Amazon? Is it in more?
Yeah, it's on Amazon. It's on Barnes and Noble. You know, their online store, and you can get it through the publisher. Glass Spider Publishing. It's also in some of the independent bookstores in my area. The New England Mobile Book Fair recently stocked it. We had our book launch there, and we're attempting to, you know, get it to more outlets. But the easiest way is, you know, probably because most people already have an account at Amazon or Barnes and Noble. That's the easiest way to get a copy. Right now, it's in hardcover and Kindle. The paperback version will come out in beginning of October, I think the first week of October.
That's great. And do you have a website that you'd like people to come and say hi?
I would say, I do have a landing page and so forth, but it's kind of, honestly, I don't want to publicize it, and I'll be very frank, it's kind of ugly. That said, tomorrow I'm talking with a colleague of mine. We're going to get a more pleasant and industrial strength website set up. In the meantime, you know, folks can, you know, find my author page on Facebook. They can certainly look me up on Amazon. I have an author, you know, profile there, and I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. So if you're hanging out on LinkedIn, you can always connect with me there.
Okay. All right. I want to thank you for coming on the show. I hope you enjoyed it.
I did. I learned a lot, too. Thank you.
It's one of my favorite things is talking and just chatting about stuff, not just just not just books, but life.
Right. I'll just mention one other thing, if it's all right, Sherry. If someone is interested in reviewing the book, they can contact me via my email, which is cazara@gmail, my first initial and last name together. And we can send me an email if you're interested in doing a review, and we'll work out something.
Great. Thank you very much for coming on the show.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting. Bye-bye. Thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Bye-bye.